Good morning. We're reading today from Zechariah chapter 9, and you'll find that if you're following along in the Bibles on page 665, otherwise on the screen. A prophecy. The word of the Lord is against the land of Hadrach and will come to rest on Damascus, for the eyes of all people and all the tribes of Israel are on the Lord, and on Hamath too, which borders on it, and on Tyre and Sidon, though they are very skillful. Tyre has built for herself a stronghold. She has heaped up silver like dust and gold like the dirt of the streets. But the Lord will take away her possessions and destroy her power on the sea, and she will be consumed by fire. Ashkelon will see it and fear. Gaza will writhe in agony, and Ekron too, for her hope will wither. Gaza will lose her king, and Ashkelon will be deserted. A mongrel people will occupy Ashdod, and I will put an end to the pride of the Philistines. I will take the blood from their mouths, the forbidden food from between their teeth. Those who are left will belong to our God and become a clan in Judah, and Ekron will be like the Jebusites. But I will encamp at my temple to guard it against marauding forces. Never again will an oppressor overrun my people, for now I am keeping watch. Rejoice greatly, daughter Zion. Shout, daughter Jerusalem. See, your king comes to you, righteous and victorious, lowly and riding on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. I will take away the chariots from Ephraim and the war horses from Jerusalem, and the battle bow will be broken. He will proclaim peace to the nations. His rule will extend from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. As for you, because of the blood of my covenant with you, I will free your prisoners from the waterless pit. Return to your fortress, you prisoners of hope. Even now I announce that I will restore twice as much to you. I will bend Judah as I bend my bow and fill it with Ephraim. I will rouse your son Zion against your son's Greece and make you like a warrior's sword. Then the Lord will appear over them. His arrow will flash like lightning. The sovereign Lord will sound the trumpet. He will march in the storms of the south, and the Lord Almighty will shield them. They will destroy and overcome with sling stones. They will drink and roar as with wine. They will be full like a bowl, used for sprinkling the corners of the altar. The Lord their God will save his people on that day, as a shepherd saves his flock. They will sparkle in his land like jewels in a crown. How attractive and beautiful they will be. Grain will make the young men thrive, and new wine the young women. This is the word of the Lord.
The passage that we're looking at, that we just read, is a vision for world peace. When you hear world peace, what do you think? Do you think it's possible? Do you think it's likely? For most of us, we look around the world at what's happening, what's in the news, what's the videos showing up in our phone, and we think, world peace, that's a pipe dream. We think we dreamed when we were children about world peace, but then we became adults and we lost our innocence. World peace, is that possible? We see that the world is complicated. We've got the 20-point peace plan for Gaza. And I was looking at the news just last week, and the BBC News said the ceasefire is almost a month old, but Israeli forces say they are still fighting Hamas gunmen along the yellow line almost every day. Hamas has accused Israel of violating the ceasefire hundreds of times. And Gaza's Hamas-run health ministry says more than 240 people have been killed as a result. How complicated is our world? World peace? We say, yeah, right, world peace. Zechariah 9 says, yeah, world peace. The first verse of Zechariah 9 says this is a prophecy. It is an oracle, a word of the Lord. And so being a message from God, it's as reliable as any other part of the Bible. If you've come here today as someone who trusts the Bible, then what you'll see from Zechariah 9 today is not only is world peace possible, but world peace is destined, determined. It's God's plan. It will happen. Verse 10 is where we center in on a vision for world peace. And it says there that God's going to take away war horses and battle bows. And the king, God's king, will proclaim peace to the nations. His rule will extend from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. This is what I'd call God's vision for world peace. So when's it going to happen? If you look at the timing in these sentences, you'll see that it's about the future. He will, his rule will. And timing-wise, the second half of Zechariah feels different from the first half of Zechariah. In the first half of Zechariah, it feels like everything promised is just about to happen. It's imminent. It's right around the corner. But when you get to the second half of Zechariah, it feels like the time horizon's pushed out and we're talking long term. People who've studied Zechariah closely and written PhDs on it seem to think the second half of Zechariah was written probably a generation or so later than the first half, and that it was written about the future. So Michael Stead's commentary puts it like this: in chapters 1 to 8, the emphasis is on the now of God's promises, whereas the emphasis of chapters 9 to 14 is on the not yet. Zechariah 9 through 14 tells a later generation that a great salvation is still to come on a future day, and that this future will only come about through struggle and hardship. So the point is that God has a vision for world peace, and it is future-oriented when we read Zechariah 9, and that they're going to arrive at it through struggle and hardship. But we hear future and sometimes we think hope, and hope is a pipe dream. But no, this is an oracle of the Lord. This is the word of the Lord meant to be received by faith, that the peace is coming. How's it going to happen? Well, Zechariah 9 is going to map that out for us. But before we jump into Zechariah 9, I want to pull out the timeline again, because you read Zechariah 9, you get all the place names and you suddenly get lost, because it's written within a context and it's a bit unfamiliar with us, to us. So just to come back to our timeline that we've been looking at over the last few weeks, God is kind to give promises to the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. He is kind and merciful to save the people of Israel from slavery in Egypt in the Exodus. And then as they seek to walk under God's laws, they actually go astray and do not follow God by faith, and they do not walk in his ways. So that by the time you get to that junction, there's a civil war and the north and south get divided. And in the end, the northern kingdom is destroyed. Samaria is destroyed in 722 BC. The southern kingdom, Jerusalem, is destroyed in 586 BC. And the big golden Z is the book of Zechariah. So that's where we're trying to locate the timing of the book of Zechariah. You see down the very bottom, the people of Jerusalem are under foreign rule. They've been exiled in Babylon. And then there's the three gray arrows pointing back up as three waves of people are allowed to return to Jerusalem. The point is, in context, where the big Z is, they've been at war for hundreds of years, torn, and they've had chaos and foreign rule, and from within that context, Zechariah 9 gives them a great vision of peace. So what does it say? Well, God's peace plan has to do with three parts to this passage. God's peace plan has to do with enemies, it has to do with leadership, and it has to do with salvation. I'm going to skip the last point, and hopefully you'll have had some time, or will get some time in your growth groups, to look a bit more into that. But verse 1 to 8 are all about peace from your enemies. There's lots of place names in there. And when you heard it read today, I wondered if you could stay focused or whether your mind drifted a little bit. I've done a theological degree and I've traveled to Israel, and I just want to be honest, the first time I read this chapter, my mind wandered. And that's actually normal. When you read passages like this, it's normal to be like, what is going on? There's a lot of places listed here, but it's not that complicated once you look at a map. So let's pull up a map here. On the left, you'll see the ancient kingdom of Israel, north and south divided kingdom. And on the right, you'll see a tour of this passage, the first 8 verses. And you can see on the right from verse 1, we just move, the word of the Lord moves down through the different towns, the different cities that have historically been the enemies of the people of God. These are the people who have posed a threat to Israel. And so the word of the Lord moves down these cities that have come and fought against Israel. And we hear that God is going to stop the enemies from oppressing. We read that it doesn't matter how strong they are, how skillful they are, how rich they are, how proud they are. The word of the Lord is against these cities. He is going to come in opposition. And in verse 8, it says, I will encamp at my temple to guard it against marauding forces. Never again will an oppressor overrun my people, for now I am keeping watch. Never again. Can you imagine how good it would feel to be living under Babylonian rule and the Persian rule at this time and to be told, never again? People who've been at war are the ones who really understand how terrible war is. And that's when you really understand the freedom. I saw this quote from the President of the United States after World War II. He said, I hate war as only a soldier who has lived it can, as only one who has seen its brutality, its futility, its stupidity. This is Dwight Eisenhower. And he was the commander of the Allied forces before he became president. And I can imagine that anyone who's lived through World War II or anyone who's been at the middle of a war would see how horrible it is. And that is the people of Jerusalem. They've been at war for so long. And then they hear this next sentence, never again will an oppressor overrun my people. This is good news, precious news, lasting peace. But there's a fun little surprise in verse 7. I wonder if you noticed it. In verse 7, it talks about the Philistines. The Philistines are the prototypical enemy. The Philistines are the people that they've always been warring with. And verse 7 talks about how Philistines are going to be welcomed into the people of God. It talks about God taking away the things that defile them, and those who are left will belong to our God. This phrase, those who are left, is literally a remnant of the Philistines, a remnant of your enemies are going to come and be part of the people of God. This would be hard for the Jewish people to imagine. Only God would be able to bring together enemies and join them as one people. That's the vision of Zechariah. The second part of God's peace plan has to do with leadership. Leadership really matters, doesn't it? If you are under a great leader, they make your life excellent. If you're under a terrible leader, they can make your life really bad. In God's plan for leadership, verse 9 says that He's going to send a righteous king that rides on a donkey. Zechariah 9, 9 to 10. Rejoice greatly, daughter Zion. Shout, daughter Jerusalem. See, your king comes to you, righteous and victorious, lowly and riding on a donkey. He will proclaim peace to the nations. These words sound a lot like Zechariah chapter 2, verse 10. So if you compare it there side by side, it's as if this man riding on a donkey receives the same joyful welcome as the Lord himself, and it makes you wonder whether the coming of the king on the donkey and the coming of the Lord is the same moment. Clearly, he is a man because he's riding on a donkey. But unlike the rest of us, he is called righteous. He is good. He is godly. He is godlike in character. He is righteous, which means he's the kind of leader that you want. He's the kind of leader you look up to. And God will give this leader authority and responsibility to lead the world in peace. But what's the go with this sentence here where it says lowly and riding on a donkey? I rang up the local expert in donkeys. We've got a guy at night church who goes to Macquarie Uni and he's doing research in donkeys in the ancient world. What a fun project. I said, Grisha, what's the go with the donkey thing? And he said, we totally misunderstand donkeys. He said, we tend to think donkeys not fit for a king. It's a bit stinky and bumpy, you know, they'd probably ride horses. Grisha says, no, that's wrong. If you read that in the commentaries, he says that's wrong. Because apparently in the ancient world, the further you go back, the more it was actually quite common to associate donkeys and kings. So I'm going to show you something that Grisha sent me from the 1700s BC from an old Babylonian city that fell to the Hammurabi. It said, my lord should honor his kingship. Since you are king of the Hennians and secondly you are king of Akkad, my lord should not ride on horses. On palanquin and donkeys my lord should ride. His kingship he should honor. So I'm going to back Grisha in on this one and say, when we think of donkeys, we automatically think lowly, humble symbol. But actually, in the older you go back, the more it was associated with kingship. And if you think of Solomon, the great king of the Old Testament, 1 Kings 1, the day he was anointed, he rode a donkey. I don't know if you've seen that before. So donkey isn't actually the weird bit. The weird bit is the word lowly. So what's the go with the word lowly? If you look at the common translation for the word lowly, it is usually just translated poor. In the rest of the Old Testament, most of the time you see the word lowly, it's just translated poor, meaning socioeconomically poor, someone who is without. Sometimes it's metaphorical and it's poor in spirit, which means humble. And so the idea of a humble king comes to the fore. Often in the Psalms and other locations in the Old Testament, the lowliness is associated with suffering or affliction. And so sometimes lowly is translated afflicted. I think what we're meant to get a picture of is putting all that together. The king is going to be afflicted and lowly and humble. So this is a lot to imagine about a king who's going to bring peace to the world. How can an afflicted, lowly, poor king bring peace to the world? Well, that's where we get to Jesus. I'm going to skip the third part of our Zechariah passage and go to the New Testament so we can draw it all together through the person of Jesus Christ. Last week, Tom was speaking and he said the second half of Zechariah has some of the most quoted verses in the entire New Testament. I don't know if you've noticed this before. All four Gospels reference Jesus riding a donkey. He enters Jerusalem on a donkey. And as they wave the palm branches and celebrate the coming of the Lord, Jesus walks in on a donkey. And the Gospel of Matthew makes it most explicit. Matthew 21:4. This took place to fulfill what was spoken through the prophet. Say to daughter Zion, see your king comes to you, gentle and riding on a donkey and on a colt, the foal of a donkey. What Matthew and the New Testament authors want us to realize is Jesus is the king on the donkey that fulfills Zechariah chapter 9. He is the king of peace. But that said, the people in Jerusalem didn't recognize what was going on. Jesus is not the kind of king they were expecting. They were expecting someone who would overthrow Roman rule at that time, Babylonians, then, you know, world history goes, Roman rule. They were looking for a king on a horse. They were looking for a military leader. But Jesus comes along humble, lowly, poor. Jerusalem did not accept him. This is how the Gospel of Luke says it. When Jesus enters in on the donkey, the very first thing that happens is Jesus weeps. It says, as he approached Jerusalem and saw the city, he wept over it and said, "If you, even you, had only known on this day what would bring you peace, but now it is hidden from your eyes." The gospel authors want us to see Jesus is the King of world peace, but Jerusalem could not recognize it. And Jesus wept over Jerusalem. In fact, 5 days later, Jerusalem, with the help of the Romans, had Jesus killed. Jesus, the King of world peace, is afflicted? Well, here's the beauty. The cross is where we see the affliction and humility of the King in its most pure form. The cross is where we see the affliction of God's lowly King. And the twist is that the cross is the place where Jesus brings peace to the world. 1 Peter 3:18, Christ also suffered once for sins, suffering, affliction, lowliness. The righteous for the unrighteous. He is the righteous King. Who is unrighteous? Well, not only the Philistines who have come and attacked God's people, but even Jerusalem who have killed God's King. The righteous for the unrighteous. It doesn't matter where you come from, Jew and Gentile, all of us are unrighteous. But Christ suffered for sins to bring us to God. This is God's peace plan. He brings us into reconciliation with God. And by bringing different people together in reconciliation to God, he brings us to reconciliation with each other at the same time. I'll tell you a couple of stories. I was talking to a lady this week. She told me an amazing backstory in her life. It is a hard story, but really powerful. She told me in 1997, her parents were traveling through Europe delivering Bibles with open doors. They were delivering the message of peace to the world. Their camper van broke down in Hungary. It ended really badly. It's a horror story. And along came some people pretending to be police and asked them for money. They did pay the bribe. The police left, but they weren't really police. They came back during the night, only this time they came with weapons, and I'll spare you the details. But Dad was killed, Mum was beaten, and 3 days later, Mum was in hospital, and they put the camera on her for the news. And this is what she said. "I don't bear any malice towards them. In fact, I actually pray that they'll become Christians." Later on, Mum visited István in prison, the murderer, and she gave him a Bible and told him she forgives him. A few years later, István sent her a letter in the mail. The letter said, this was the title of the letter, "I caused death, but had received life in exchange." His letter explained that he finally understood why Christ died on the cross, that Jesus died on the cross for the forgiveness of sins, even though he had killed someone. And he wrote in the letter that, "That night I prayed to God as to my Father. I asked him to forgive me. As soon as I declared myself sinful, I started to cry, and the Lord Jesus lifted the burden." I know this is a really heavy story, but I wanted to bring an extreme example to prove the power of peace that Christ brings. The peace of Christ has the power to reconcile victims and perpetrators into the peace of God. István didn't deserve peace, obviously. István was a murderer. But because of the King of Peace, István the murderer received double mercy. He received divine mercy and human mercy. This is the power of Christ at the cross. He received the forgiveness of sins through Christ and the forgiveness of a Christian through this lady who'd lost her husband.
The other reason I really wanted to share this story is because I like the line, "I caused death but had received life in exchange," because it mirrors some of the things that are going on in the gospel. If you think about it, the murder of Jesus is no less gruesome than what István had done. We're a bit desensitized to it because we hear about the cross all the time, but Jesus was beaten and then hung on a cross to be killed. Who was responsible? Who killed Jesus? Well, this time it wasn't István. This time it wasn't even the Philistines. This time it was the very people of God, the Jewish people, along with the Romans and those who lived in the city. Because there is no difference between Jew and Gentile, between Israel and Palestine, between Australian and anywhere else in the world. All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. And what does God give us in exchange? Well, István knows. We cause death, but we receive life in exchange. So coming back to our original question, what hope is there of world peace? And the answer, I'm guessing you'll agree, is there is no hope through tanks and guns and people of violence. If there is any hope, as Zechariah 9 says that there is, it's going to have to happen through divine intervention and a lowly king riding on a donkey. And that's where Jesus fits. He is the King of Peace, lowly and gentle, riding on a donkey. And the cross is where he is afflicted to inaugurate God's peace plan. Jesus takes enemies and he reconciles them to God and he reconciles them to each other by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. And it doesn't matter who you are, we're all one in Christ. Even the Philistines are welcome. I tell you something interesting. I don't know if you knew this, but in English, the word Palestine is derived from the same root word as Philistine. And what's interesting is that in the Arabic Bible, when you read the Old Testament, the word Philistine is exactly the same as the modern word Palestine. And so if you're an Arab reading the Bible and you live in Palestine, when you read the Old Testament, sometimes it comes across a little confronting when it talks about the Philistines as enemies of God. But Palestinian Christians love Zechariah chapter 9 because it says there that even the Philistines or the Palestinians will be welcomed and included among the people of God. And did you know it's already happening now? I was listening to a sermon by Chris Wright, who was talking about his Palestinian friend, Dr. Riyad Kassis. And he said, Riyad is a Syrian Christian living in Lebanon. So he's an Arab from a long-time Christian family. And Riyad was telling me just a few weeks ago that he gets really rather amused, at least amused when he's not upset, when Christians, especially Western Christians, ask him, "Hey, you're an Arab. How come you're a Christian?" And he says, "Listen, I was born in Syria, which you may remember is where they invented the word Christian and called the followers of Jesus Christians for the first time in Antioch. I spent my student days living in Damascus on Straight Street, which is where Saul of Tarsus was baptized by Ananias. And you asked me, how come I'm a Christian? And didn't you know from Acts chapter 1 that there were Arabs in Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost? And you ask, how come I'm a Christian?" So it's happening already. Palestinians becoming the people of God included. So what I want to say then as we draw things towards a close is that peace already exists in the Middle East, no matter how small and fragile it looks. Because in the state of Israel and in the state of Palestine, there's people on both sides who follow Jesus and are reconciled to each other through the peace of the cross. It's the seed of peace that's growing in our world as we eagerly await the final day of God's intervention, when never again will God's people be overrun by marauding forces. In the meantime, can I suggest a Christian way of thinking about the war in Gaza is that instead of taking a side or being prejudiced because of a misguided reading of the Old Testament, we should all without hesitation acknowledge that everyone, Jew and Palestinian, are both welcomed by God, just like Istvan is, because of the blood of Christ shed at the cross. And we should pray for the spread of the gospel in that land so that more people would find his peace and put down their guns as we wait for him to return. As the band comes up, I'm going to lead us in prayer. Our God in heaven, we long for peace. Thank you so much for sending Jesus, the humble King, who died that we might have peace and reconciliation. Please spread this good message around the world and expand your peace and come back soon. Amen.